Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Colavita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, welcome to Food Talk, the February snow edition. Yeah, one of those days in New York City, man. We'll see what happens. We're in the middle of maybe an over-forecast blizzard, I don't know. Everybody, yesterday was freaking out. The weather stations were doing the usual super hype. Yeah, 12 inches to 16 inches. It's going to be water. I don't know. I don't think it started. So I was up till midnight. I didn't see any snow at that point. I got up this morning. It was snowing a bit, and then it turned to rain in New York by 10:30, 11 a.m., which is what it's been doing since. And now we have those wonderful 2.5-foot puddles at every corner. They're just great. Just kind of brown, slushy water that you cannot avoid stepping into. It's great. Great winter in New York City. We're having a lot of fun. All right, whatever. So what have I been up to lately? This is, I think the last time I was on, I talked about going to a new restaurant down by me on the Lower East Side called Contra. Went there, had a great time. Interesting. I hope these guys make it. It's a great place. The food is great. Service is really good. Wines were super tight. It's just a bit of a challenge because the menu that they offer every night changes. So like, if you go on the website and click menu, nothing comes up, which isn't unusual these days for restaurants. That's okay. You know, I don't need to look at the menu before I sit down at the dining room table at the restaurant. But what they do is kind of a prefix menu every night that changes every night, which is great for the chef, I think. We'll see how it works where the rubber meets the road. But it was busy when I was there. The food was great. Congratulations to them. I'll be back again. Contra, I think it was on Rivington or Stanton. Don't ask me. Google it. Had the kind of the privilege yesterday. I didn't realize we had the privilege until they told me. But I've wanted to do a show for some time on Keith McNally. Keith McNally is one of these quintessential restaurateurs that came up through the ranks. His dad was a stevedore and a taxi cab driver in England, really blue-collar kid, came over to the States with his two brothers, Brian and the other one whose name escapes me, started as a dishwasher at Serendipity, then a busboy, then was at 1 Fifth Avenue where he was in the kitchen, worked his way up in the course of a year or two, maybe a year and a half at 1 Fifth Avenue to becoming a captain. And then had the vision with his then-wife to open up a place called Odeon down in Tribeca back in the late 70s when there was really nothing back there. They took over a diner, made it a really hip room, had a chef named Patrick Clark, really one of the very few African-American chefs to this day that's risen to prominence in the city. I don't know why that is, but Patrick was a real star. And that restaurant just took off. It was the beginning of the beginning of Tribeca. It really was. Became a big hangout for Saturday Night Live crews. They'd have their after parties there, which back then probably meant a lot of weed and a lot of smack. That's what was going on, a lot of blow. Those were those days. Then he went on to open up a string of restaurants, Café Luxembourg, Lucky Strike, of course, Balthazar, Pastis. Long story short, I've wanted to do a piece on him. He's really press-phobic. He doesn't like the press. And you know what? He doesn't need the press. He's got a great following. His restaurants all make money. So it's hard to get in. So for a couple of years, I've just been, you know, dropping little hooks in the water with some bait on him to see if anybody would bite. And his chef now, his chef de cuisine for his restaurants, is Shane McBride, who I've known for the better part of 13, 14 years. I knew Shane when he was at L'Espinasse under Christian Delouvrier, one of my old bosses. So Shane and I finally put it together. So we filmed at Balthazar and Minetta Tavern yesterday all day. And I didn't realize that he's never allowed cameras ever, ever to film at Minetta. He doesn't even allow people to take pictures at Minetta. The only thing you'll see on Minetta Tavern is cell phone shots. Doesn't allow cameras inside the restaurant. Has never allowed filming. So it was kind of cool. We got in there to film with two cameras. Got the chef to do a bunch of demos, film the room, B-roll. Beautiful space, beautiful story. And then the same for Balthazar. And you can kind of see why Keith is so successful because he just gets it. He gets hospitality. A lot of his staff has been with him for the bulk of their career. He's got people that have been with him since the Odeon days, people that have been with him since Luxembourg, you know, busboys that have that own buildings in Chinatown now that have been with him for 35, 25 years. It's really not uncommon to talk to his staff and find out everyone. You're like a newbie if you've been with Keith for 5 or 6 years. And Balthazar is great. It's just a quintessential. I think everyone's gone into that place and said, I want to do one of these. It feels like you stepped off of the streets of Soho and entered, you know, the Luxembourg Gardens in Paris. It just reminds you of Brasserie Lip and Julien and all those great storied bistros that I went to in the 80s and fell in love with that kind of food, and they're doing it. Great stuff. So congratulations to Keith, who now lives in London, where the most recent iteration of Balthazar is apparently doing real well. What else is going on? Had a great meal at Pearl and Ash the other day, another great one, and this is the first time I ever spent any time in the kitchen with those guys. It's amazing. The kitchen's about the size of a walk-in closet. I shit you not, it is really tiny, and they have no gas. So the entire menu, I think the great conceit of that restaurant is the food is absolutely great, and it's the kind of food that all has to be done in advance and then portioned out and assembled at pickup on induction burners and a convection oven and a baby fryolator. That's all they had in the kitchen. Three induction burners, an electric convection oven, and a fryolator. That's it. And the food's amazing. You'd never know it. Wine list is amazing. Patrick has a killer wine list. It's just a fun dining room. It's like a party there every night. Have a guest today that's a great, great chef restaurateur. It's one of my favorite restaurants in the city, and I've said this so many times on this show and when I was at Food Talk at OR, that because I have to go out to eat a lot at new places, because it's kind of what I have to do to keep the PBS show current and to keep my opinions current in this city that moves at a speed that I don't think anybody can keep up with. So I can't go back to places I really like, because that's an indulgence, right? If I'm eating out 3 nights a week, sometimes 4, I've really got to try new places and then revisit them, and I can't go to places like Hearth or Peasant or Crispo, all the places my buddies run that I love, because that's not work. That's fun. So my guest today is Marco Canora, who is the chef proprietor of Hearth Restaurant, along with Paul Greco, who's the other half, does the front of the house, does the wines. Marco, welcome.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
Good to have you, man. So congratulations. The last time, and this is it's sort of sad, but the last time I was with you, we were talking about how great the food was at your place. I think we might have been filming there last season. And then you were kind of chomping at the bit to get re-reviewed.
Yep.
It had been 9 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the last review was, not to disparage the critic, but it was an interim critic of the New York Times between
right.
the critics of record,
yep.
who had been there a while, which is kind of like, oh, really? Like, you always feel bad when that happens, because there's always a window between the critic and the critic. Maybe sometimes it's 3 weeks or a month or 5 weeks. In this case, it was way longer. And you hate to be reviewed as a restaurant then, because it's sort of, if it sucks, you're stuck with it.
Right.
And if it's great, it doesn't count.
Kind of. But, you know, more importantly than the fact that it was an interim reviewer, and I think all the restaurateurs can sympathize with this, is the fact that it's tough to get reviewed 6 weeks in.
Oh, that
you know,
was
so
that.
It's like, yeah. And we all, it's part of the story here. You know, they chime in really early, and we all know that restaurants have, you know, there's a long life in a restaurant, you hope anyway. And while I understand this idea, if you're going to charge me full, you better be operating on all cylinders. It's kind of like the evolution of a restaurant is not something that you could kind of push through. It happens kind of naturally. So it was like to have everyone chime in at 6 weeks, you're kind of like, oh, shit. So, you know, 9 years later, knowing that 10 is coming, the notion of getting re-reviewed is really cool because, you know, a lot has happened over 10 years and you really – my God, systems have formed and you feel yeah. comfortable in your own skin and you really have you know, there's a level of comfort and ease and confidence that happens over 10 years that it's impossible to garner that in the first 6 weeks of a new restaurant.
I've said this so many times. I don't know when that happened. Probably in the late 90s or early 00s when, and I think part of it was the presence of bloggers and the web, mm-hmm. where when a restaurant opened, everybody wanted to be there the first 2 nights, taking pictures with their smartphones,
right.
posting pictures on their websites.
Or at friends and family, even.
Even friends and family. And then, you know, the eaters of the world that just sort of churning information. Grub Street. I mean, I think that was part of it, where if you were the New York Times critic and you knew in your heart's heart that you should wait 3 to 6 months before you reviewed a restaurant, you also knew that you couldn't anymore.
Right. You had to chime in early.
You had to chime in early.
It says that you're not on top of shit.
You're not. It's old news. Yep. Dude, that was 6 months ago. And I agree with you. Having been in the business all my life, man, you open a restaurant, I call it like the gestational period. It takes 6 months for the kitchen to coalesce, for you to find vendors that can bring you the food that you like, for the front of the house to understand the food,
yep.
for the front and the house, front of the house and the back of the house to mesh.
Yep.
It takes 6 months to a year to sort of become a young restaurant.
Yeah,
the first 6 weeks you're an infant. It's crazy.
And you know, and it's constantly evolving because you're really as good as your team, just like a sports team. And you know, you're turning over staff. I mean, we all know that. This industry, it's like it's a lot of young transient kids. New York City is a transient city. And, you know, it never kind of goes away. And you're constantly reinventing your team. And it's really an amazing arc of up and down. And, you know, you have, you know, right now, thankfully, at Hearth, we're experiencing a time where we have a great team in the kitchen, a great team in the front. They've all been with us for a while. And we're really like knocking on all cylinders kind of concept. But, you know, in 6 weeks, we can have two cooks give notice and three front of the house go away. And then, you know, you hope you have systems for training in place. But my point is, it's a constant evolution and you're constantly training and you're always trying to, like, keep the standards where you want them to be.
And you're a chef. You're there, man. You're in the kitchen.
I'm in the
cooking.
Kitchen.
You love the process.
I do. Imagine that.
Yeah, but you still do. Because I think there's, you know, I think there's, every chef's a bit different. Every person's a little bit different. I think there are people that get in the business. They sort of can't wait just to be able to step out and put it on autopilot and get the TV show or do the book tour or open up five more restaurants just like it and not be around.
Well, listen, don't get me wrong. I want to grow and we are growing and I'm not adverse to that concept. But you're right. Like I do what I do because I like what I do and it's like kind of what identifies me. It's like everything this is who I am and what I do. And without like going to Hearth and being in the kitchen with my team of people, like, that's what my life is. I would feel, I don't know what I would do without that, you know?
Talk about, the people that are listening, you know, we're a webcast station, and it's not just national, it's probably global. So I'm going to make an assumption that a fair amount of people that are listening haven't heard me interview you on WOR and haven't seen the PBS piece of dinner. So roll back the tape. How'd you get in the business? Give us that backstory of Mark Okunor as a young man saying, actually, this is kind of what I want to do.
You know, upstate New York, high school, there was a restaurant up, you know, a mile away from where I lived in Milton, New York, on Route 9W. It was called the Ship Lantern Inn. And it was like, you know, right on the highway with this big sign, Ship Lantern Inn. And it was like prime rib and lobster tail and veal piccata. And, you know, this is the mid-80s, right? So I'm kind of a dinosaur.
Wait, don't say that, because that would make me more...
Exactly. What does that make
you? An extinct dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly. So it was run by the Folia family, which John Folia was the old man. It was a three-generation restaurant in upstate New York. John Folia was the old man who started Chef Boyardee. And he ended up selling his interest after like 3 or 5 years because he was like, there's no future in this shit. It's garbage. Canned ravioli. He sold his interest, and then look at what happened with Chef Boyardee. But anyway... I was a dishwasher, you know, and it's like I got the fucking bug. You get the bug. I mean, a lot of people I speak with, it is like that. You get the bug because it's high energy. It's constantly evolving and constantly changing. You got balls in the air and it's fun and it's invigorating. And I remember watching the chefs do their thing and I was like, that's so goddamn cool. And then I got to know the chef, and the chef was a really cool dude. And he, you know, it was like fire and knives, and he was like cutting beef and eating like salty meat off of the prime rib bones that you take out, you know. And he would throw me a prime rib bone, and it's like, and I got the bug. And, you know, fortunately, I grew up in a house where food was important, and I loved food. And then I got introduced to the restaurant business, and I loved the vibe. And I was like, well, this makes a lot of sense for me. Like, I really like this. And I like that it wasn't 9 to 5. And I like that it wasn't, like, up in the morning and, like, with the masses, you know. And I think, you know, it was a good fit for me. And here I am, I don't know how many years later, but here I am still doing that thing, you know. And You know, it certainly is not an easy way of life by any stretch of the imagination. But I truly feel fortunate to be a guy who doesn't dread his work and doesn't live for Friday. I mean, I feel like I'm really lucky that I don't. I think it's kind of awful and sad that, you know, many people begin their Monday with the hope and praying for the TGI Friday thing. And it's like, it's unfortunate. So I am one of the lucky ones. I found the restaurant business, and it's been a great ride.
Did you do cooking school in between at any point? Or you didn't
no cooking it? School. Didn't I went to no, I didn't go to cooking school. I went to Pace University in Manhattan and got my degree in international business. And you know, worked through, you know, all through high school, all through college, it was always restaurants. Yeah. And then it was kind of like I did a little stint in the music business for a little bit and sat at the desk, and I was like, this blows. Like, this is not for me. It doesn't suck for everyone, but it wasn't a right fit for me. You know, it was over across from the David Letterman thing. It was in the, 13th floor of big Midtown office building. And every day I'd go get a sausage sandwich and a can of Coke. And like, I was at the phone and the guy behind me was screaming all day. He was like booking, you know, musical acts. And I was like, get me out of here.
Who'd you work with in the city? 'Cause you had a great background coming up.
You know, I am not a guy who has a very deep resume. When I went to college at Pace, I worked at Dean and DeLuca, and I did prepared foods and I made soups for a while. Really honed my knife skills because they would, you know, that store on Prince and Broadway.
Yeah,
I mean, we would go through 60 gallons of soup a day. And I made those soups, so the amount of carrots, celery, and onions I had to chop.
The mere
like, walking. I was badass knife skills. Like, I could bang stuff out. And, you know, in the holiday season, I remembered, like, lobster bisque and just, like, you know, cases and cases of lobster every day, walking into, you know, 12 cases of lobsters. So that was, like, you know, when I first came to New York City. And then motorcycle cross country, did some cooking in Boulder, did some cooking in San Francisco for a couple years. And then not until I came back in like 27-ish, I was kind of like, okay, cooking for me has been like really just animal house parties, you know, a means to women and alcohol and drugs. And
yeah,
now that I'm 27.
You like, and everybody
and
else.
Yeah. You and now that I'm 27, I'm getting older. I need to make a decision. And is this what I want to do and whatever? And I knew it's what I wanted to do. And I put a list together of restaurants of where I was going to go to. And on the top of that list was Gramercy Tavern.
That's what I read. So you were with Tom.
Yep.
That's what I thought. Opened. I mean, at one point you were in that kitchen at that time when it was firing on all cylinders. And Tom was a younger version of Tom. I remember his I remember his food at Mondrian.
Yep.
And it was, at that point, I was a young chef in the city. I don't think I was yet a chef at the Ritz-Carlton. I might have been at Tavern on the Green. I don't know where I was. I don't remember the exact year. But I remember I'd been to Europe a bunch, and I'd been to a lot of 3- and 2-star Michelin restaurants in France and in Italy. And I remember eating at Mondrian and thinking, this is probably the best restaurant in New York at the time.
Badass.
Amy Sherber was baking the bread. Tom's food was killer. Then he went on to do Raquel with Thomas Keller.
Yep.
He was actually the sous chef, and then he floated around a bit, and he ended up at Gramercy, which is kind of his coming out party.
Yeah,
but at that
really
point,
was.
When that kitchen coalesced, talk about who was in the kitchen when you were there.
Benno was there. Damon Wise went through there. Ed Carew, Sisha Ortuzar. You know, a lot of the guys went through there. And I was there. I was a fish cook there when Ruth Reichel came back around after they'd been open for 2 years and dropped the 3 stars on them. And I tell you, like, as a young guy, kind of just in New York City, working in this really, you know, I was blown away when I saw that kitchen, like a year old kitchen. I'd never seen a kitchen like that. And to be a part of that review process when Ruth Reichel was out there in the dining room and Tom was around, and it was kind of like, we're going to cook 2 of everything. And Tom was on the meat station, like helping the meat person. And I was on the fish station, like shitting my pants because I was like, oh my God, like I'm cooking meat now for all of a sudden I'm cooking meat for the New York Times reviewer.
Right.
And
I fucked this up. I'm dead.
You know, and it was, I would say it was kind of a bigger deal back then maybe than it is now. 'Cause it's just the environment is different. But man, like the sense of pride I had when he didn't come to my station and let me do it. And when I read that review and she talked about the cod dish and she talked about the bass dish and how much she loved it, and how perfectly cooked it was, and to feel like, holy shit, like
I can do
that
this.
Was me, right? Right? That was like, my God, like what a feeling, you know? So again, it's like it kind of built on itself, and you kind of get it sucks you in, you know.
It's funny. It's so many of the chefs. You're younger than I am by maybe a decade, but so many of the chefs of our generation, with me being on the, you know, whether I talk to Charlie Palmer, there, so many of guys have that same story of, we weren't really academics. We didn't like school much. God. We were kind of knuckleheads. Yep. We started out in the pot. We started out at 13. It's my story. It's 13 years old as a pot washer.
Yep.
One day a prep cook calls
peeling
in
potatoes.
Sick. So the next day they say, hey, make Calameco. Can you do the grill? Yes,
yeah.
sir.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you've got an apron on and you're shucking clams and oysters and portioning out pecan
That's
pie.
Right.
But you're with this, you're like this kid hanging out with these cool old guys.
That's exactly
and back
right.
then, the old guys, when I was a young guy in Philadelphia, these guys weren't chefs. They weren't like trained French guys. These were like ex-Marines, ex-Navy guys.
Ex-cons.
They had t-shirts and tattoos.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly that everyone smoked cigarettes in the kitchen.
Yep.
And the cutting boards, the wooden cutting boards, were lined with burn marks from putting the cigarette
that
down to carve prime rib or plate some food up.
Yeah.
The food was coming out of the bain-marie. But you were part of this like adult party that you got in on.
Yep.
Once in a while there was booze. They'd let you have a glass of Matus, and the waitresses were salty. You know, these ladies. With funny shoes on, or you know,
take out the garbage and smoke some weed at the end of the night.
It was the shit. You had cash at the end of the day, which many of your friends. And I remember just thinking, and even the smells, the scents of the kitchen.
Oh right? Yeah,
to go in and just hear that a sautoir working, and
right?
The convection oven, that roast, that smell. I fell in love with it.
Yeah, and the behind the scenes thing, you know, it's like you're behind the scenes of the show, just like backstage at a concert.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get access to the best, tastiest bits of stuff, and you feel like, I don't know, you're just, it's a great place to be. I still love the kitchen very much.
Yeah, and I think that's a commonality with, again, I don't know if you know Shane McBride, but, you know, Shane's a
working guy. I do. I know him well. He comes to Hearth quite often.
Good guy. Working class guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one point he was with the Louvrier at L'Espinasse, and that was absolutely one of the greatest kitchens in the history of New York. Got 4-star from the Times. The Michelin wasn't here, but if it was, it would have been a 3-star shoe-in.
I can't wait to see what Shane does at Polino's relaunch, right?
Well, we're talking about that.
Because he's going to be the guy there.
He's going to be the guy. Well, he's going to be the guy with Chino. You know Chino from Minetta?
Yes.
So Chino, tattoos on his neck. Cool
guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chino's a pretty intense guy. Chino's been at Minetta since the opening. And it's from what I tell, and I don't want to leak anything, so I don't want to breach any confidences, but it's going to – I mean, Keith's not going to take it far out of the wheelhouse of
what
he
French
does.
It's French Bistro,
it's French
right?
Bistro. So it's going to be like Schiller's.
Yep.
It's going to be a little less – upmarket than Minetta, little different than Balthazar and Schiller's, to make it a little different.
Right.
Maybe more fish, a little lighter on the menu, but they're going to kill it.
I think so. I mean, Shane's a super talented dude, and that company, I mean, my God, they know how to do stuff.
So Balthazar alone, because we filmed there yesterday, so in interest of full disclosure, as obviously you heard the intro, we did them
that
in
place
Minetta
is
Tavern.
A beast.
320 employees at Balthazar.
Oh, God.
It doesn't stop. There's prep going on at night. The early shift comes in at 5, 6 a.m.
24/7.
I forget
and
what it was.
365, I believe,
365.
Too.
800 pounds of potatoes for French fries.
Yeah.
The onion soup. I watched the guys with the Swiss kettle making onion soup in these vault-sized batches.
I can't wrap my head around
it's a machine.
I have no idea what that is
I remember when
I talked to Shane a lot about it because I want to hear what it's like, and he's like, dude, you have no idea.
Yeah, it's like riding
from the restaurants that I came from and where he came from. It's a total different beast, right?
So to that, it's funny. So when I was coming up, I worked in Philly, which kind of didn't count, but it did because it made me I went to the CIA with 10 years under my belt. By 24, I'd already cooked for 10 years, so I knew what it was. I knew how to sharpen a knife. I knew how to stand on my feet, how to cut, how to work. So I got a lot out of the CIA when I went, but I knew I didn't want to come back to Philly. So I came to New York, worked at the Four Seasons restaurant, and then the Maurice with Christian Delouvrier for 2.5 years as his sous chef.
Mm.
And then Windows in the World had a little restaurant called The Cellar in the Sky that was this jewel of a little 30-seat prefix. It was one guy did everything, me, from amuse-bouche to dessert. Eberhard Mueller was my boss then. And so to your point, I remember thinking, like, coming out of Cellar in the Sky, like, what do I want to do next? Because I don't know where I'm going to be in 10 years, and I want a really good resume, and I want a balanced resume, because we're just, I mean, back then, what was your dream? To be a chef.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no TV, there was no book deal, it was like that. We were chefs.
Yep.
So your dream was to be an executive chef somewhere. So I remember thinking, And I took a job, because it paid well, too. Tavern on the Green is the night chef. And I remember, and the money was great. The money, it just doubled my money from in Hilco. Windows didn't pay much either. And I just remember the first time I was making, you know, in 1985, 86, I'm making 60 grand a year with benefits. And, you know, I can afford a nice apartment.
That's not bad.
Killed myself working 6 days a week. But the tavern thing was the same thing as, I mean, it wasn't nearly as good as Balthazar. I won't fool anybody. But it was this idea. It was like triage. It was like, how the hell? I mean, Balthazar will do between, on a slow day, 900 covers on a slow day. God. On a busy day, it's 18.
That's insane.
It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, 200 covers at Hearth at dinner is you know, a beat down. So I can't even imagine. I mean, obviously, it's different. You have much bigger staff and stuff, but still, that's a big number.
And the menus design, they do so much. I mean, oh, you know, you really think about, like, everything's designed to be done ahead of time so that at pickup,
super fast.
We're not deglazing. We're not, those onions are already caramelized. It just goes on a plate. Your mise en place is all set.
Yeah, there's stuff you could do.
Yeah, it's fast.
Which I learned because we just opened up brunch, and brunch is one of those meal periods that it's like fast and furious, and it's like, my God, man, whatever you could, if it's scoop and serve, it's a win.
You have to.
Yeah, you kind of you have no choice.
Brunch is funny, isn't it? I mean, as a chef,
Brunch is a beast.
It
took us 10 years to, you know.
Want
to
do it.
I was the one who didn't want to do it.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I think
no way in hell. I was like, I can't give up my Saturday. It's the busiest. I had a million valid excuses. And then all of a sudden, you're kind of like, I'm leaving money on the table. Brunch is the hugest thing. We're in the East Village. And I remember, like, I put together an incredibly compelling case to present, because I had to get my team of managers on board, right? Including my chef de cuisine and my sous chef and my pastry chef and the front of the house managers. Like, nobody's going to want to do it. Nobody's going to be like, yeah, let's do it. Like, who wants to do that? No. Get up early after a busy Saturday night and open up. Nobody wanted to do it. So thankfully, I was able to kind of put together a compelling enough case and sell it to everybody. And now we're doing it. And it has been gangbusters. I mean, from the moment we opened, it has been one of the best business decisions we have ever made at Hearth Restaurant.
You've turned two periods of time when you had no service and there was no income
and you need
into
to
mini
it.
Gold mines.
Oh, my God.
I know you need to do it, but I'll tell you what. As chefs, I don't know a single chef that doesn't hate the fuck out of brunch. We just hate it. It's the kind of food we don't like. It's the kind of service we don't like. And you said it interrupts. It's the two busiest days of the week. So, like, you're coming out of Friday night. You got to get your crew in early on Saturday. You do shit like poached eggs and fucking French toast and waffles.
I tell you what.
Tons of bacon and sausage.
Yeah, the turnover from after Saturday brunch into Saturday night
dinner. Is it 1 hour? Is it an hour and a half?
We hope to have the cooks up there by 3 o'clock. So from 3 until 5:30, it's a couple hours. But still, it's a beast.
It's a beast. Yeah. I think Balthazar is an hour, maybe less than
an hour. Well, Balthazar, like, they never stop.
Well, they never stop.
Right? It's like continuous.
I remember Tavern turning over brunch to dinner was literally an hour. Brunch, the last order went out at 4. We were open for dinner at 5.
Yep.
And I just remember you're pulling mats out of the kitchen. You're hosing down eggs that had fallen down and chunks of bacon, sausage. And then the two crews, the dinner crews coming in. There's mise en place clashing.
Yeah.
Stuff coming. It was just nuts.
But you know the cool thing is that, you know, what seemed to be this monster hump to get over, it's like now it's part of the program, right. You got to remind yourself that all the time. That it's like, you know, change is good and you're going to adapt. Right? Because the first couple of months, it was kind of like everybody just wanted to have fucking poopy pants about it. And they just, you know what I mean? Like, it was just like, this is such a horrible idea. Like, see why? This sucks. And it's like, and now a year later, we're like, everybody is on the same page of, this is the best. We have a bigger staff now. We're bringing in more dollars. We're utilizing the tomato juice from the canned tomatoes that we never did. You know, there's a million reasons why this was a great idea. And everybody's comfortable. And for all you operators out there, like, remember, like, it's a business, and like, we are a resilient group, and we adapt and figure out ways to make things work, right?
Word, true. Which is why brunch exists. But as an industry insider, man, we just, it's like, whatever.
Nobody wants it.
It totally makes sense on paper because it's two underutilized service periods where you're just printing money, and New Yorkers love brunch. Yeah. Like
nobody,
it or not.
You know, it's not fun.
But whoever
said it was going to be fun?
No, the public loves it, and you're making money, and it's a business. And
that's
You know, we'll talk about that in another minute. My guest is Marco Canora. He's one of the co-owners with Paul Greco of Hearth Restaurant. We're going to talk about terroir after this break, which is a great concept that they launched The first one right next door to Hearth years back, where they could utilize the Hearth kitchen and the little kitchen in Terroir to figure out how to pair wonderful, wonderful, delicious, wine-friendly foods with an incredible wine-by-the-glass list. But hold on for a minute. This is radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. It's Food Talk here. And we should let you know. We know Heritage Radio Network takes donations. We also bring in some underwriters, so we're going to hear from a couple of the sponsors that help make this and the other shows possible. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
Hey there. Can I call you baby?
You're listening to Baby by Brothers NYC on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved using for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from, because I'm always curious with ingredients, what is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots, where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Mike Colomeco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet, pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Folks, welcome back. Listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. If I don't hit myself in the head with the headphones. Michael, come on. You've done this before. All right, hold on. Oh, there we go. Sorry about that. Yeah, Mike Colomeco here live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. I don't know if this is actually technically Bushwick. Somebody once told me it was Williamsburg. But it is the epicenter of New York hipsterdom. It's just deep with beards and beanies and
we're too old to be here, buddy.
That's right, man. I leave every day and they wave goodbye and I head back to that retirement community known as Manhattan. I take the L train back with the old folks where I belong. And I'm okay with that.
Yep.
I like it there. I'm comfortable there. Been there since 82. That's what I call home. But more power to you. It's their time now. Marco, let's talk about my guest. Excuse me, I should re-ID. I remember how to do radio. But I should re-ID my guest. My guest is Marco Canora. He is a chef and is the chef owner and partner with his front of the house guy and wine geek extraordinaire, Mr. Paul Greco. Together, they own Hearth Restaurant, which is 12th and 2nd or 1st?
1st.
12th and 1st Avenue in Manhattan, celebrating their 10th year anniversary. They got a really, really good review, their second review, in 9 years from the New York Times just this year, so I want to congratulate them on that. And they've also launched this great concept of wine bars, which are really, I remember going to Paris in the 80s and going like Willie's and some of the early wine bars in Paris. And why isn't anybody doing this in New York? It's such a great concept of simple food.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be just simple plates of food, salumi, salads with roast beets, cheeses, you know, just simple things that don't require a big kitchen. Sandwiches, paninis that will work with wine. And then presenting wines by the glass so that you don't have to commit yourself to a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And this allows, some people are so into wine today. This allows you to go in with a friend or two and maybe have a flight of 3, 4, or 5 glasses of wines of varietals you might not be familiar with, regions you not be familiar with, and just kind of develop a palate. I don't think there's any better way to develop a palate than drinking wines, keeping notes a little bit, and then finding out what you like, and your wine bar is perfect for that.
You know, without side-by-side comparisons, it's really hard to understand the language of wine tasting. And, you know, in a lot of ways with food, too, it's like not until you taste a cauliflower from the market next to the foxy cauliflower can you really understand and until it resonates with you, like, holy cow, like, this really is different. And the same with wine. I mean, I think to just taste one glass of wine, it's more impactful to taste it next to something else, because then you could be like, oh, yeah, like, that assy barnyard thing is in this one, and this one is, like, you know, concentrated berry fruit. And if they're next to each other, it sings a little bit more, you know, it speaks to you more. But, yeah, terroirs have been great. You know, the latest one on the High Line, you know, 6 months a year is just, it's fantastic up there. You know, you got a view of the river, you're sipping on some great juice and eating some simple, you know, meatball sandwich or something.
How many total terroirs do you have now?
4.5.
Okay.
Because the High Line 6 months
and the weather's good.
Yeah. So we recently went out to Park Slope, Brooklyn. Nice corner spot right next to Blue Ribbon on Fifth Avenue. And it's been, you know, I love the wine bars. I love the concept. I love that it's, you know, it lacks any kind of pretension. You know, they're smart, they're simple, you know, easier to execute than a Hearth where we're cooking everything a la minute and there's like every second 20 things can go wrong, you know.
Right.
It's kind of nice to do that approach of the wine bar approach, which for me in the back of the house is kind of like, you know, big batches of things. So it's like if I know that 100 orders of this risotto ball was made great, then I don't need to bang my head against the wall to make sure that risotto ball is coming out right every time because it's more batch work and stuff. Terroir has been awesome. You know, thanks a lot to Paul. I mean, Paul is the real, you know, the real force behind the. I think Paul is what makes Terroir Wine Bar great.
Yeah, Paul's a force. I mean, we don't have Paul on the radio today because I can't pull both of you out of the restaurant at the same time. It doesn't work. But for those of you that don't know, Paul also worked at Gramercy. Or his wife worked at Gramercy?
Yeah, no, he was at Gramercy.
Paul was
for
at Gramercy
10 years.
Too. Paul worked at Gramercy and again came up in the restaurant business kind of by accident. He's got a great story. We'll get him on the show. I mean, I have wine guests on this show at least once or twice a month, and we talk about nothing but wine for the hour. But Paul's got a great palate, a great philosophy. He's an endless promoter of wines. And I think his take is great because it's really sort of idiosyncratic.
Yeah. The thing I think that differentiates Terroir is the fact that he puts an immense amount of time and effort into training the staff so that if you sit down at Terroir, you know, this person behind the bar, this person on the floor who's going to engage you in what you want to drink, like they could really take you for a ride, and they could really, they have been trained extensively to have a conversation and educate you on what it is that, you know, what it is that you like. And sometimes you don't even know what you like, right? And you need somebody to hold your hand.
Or take you to an area that you're not familiar. I mean, maybe you don't know wines from the Jura. This is 1% of the French production. It's so very specific wines. And if they can and then suddenly you're just sitting at a table and it's a revelation.
Right. Like, and in a lot of ways, I think, you know, we do that as good as anybody out there.
Yeah, you do. You do, and Paul's great, and the whole wine thing's amazing. I'm just the wine.
I've been so fascinated.
The wine scene in America. We're one of the only. I think the only place where our per capita consumption is increasing. I'm noticing a younger and younger demo gets wine and is smart about wine.
Yep.
And I think as Paul once and I discussed when you went back to my time, even your time in New York, my time was sort of the '80s. Yours maybe the '90s into the '00s, the early '00s. You can't name four restaurants in the 90s that had a Somme on the floor. It didn't exist as a job. It did not exist.
Right.
Fast forward 20 years later, every single restaurant that's worth its salt has a Somme or a beverage director, and the staff are educated.
That's
so
right.
We're meeting about wine. We're tasting wine with the perfect every night before. We're talking about what's going to work with the meal.
Right.
It's crazy.
It is crazy, and it's such a dynamic field, and it's just it never ends. My God,
and the wines
with
that are coming here,
and producers, and it's just like
the wine making is getting better. I look at Italy in the last 20 years and just think, wow, what a turnaround I see out of Italy. Regions like Languedoc-Roussillon, the Loire, the Jura. Small wines that never made it out of those countries are now finding their way through
Burgoy.
I mean,
I just had a great Burgoy last night.
Insane.
Tremendous.
Insane. And these are wines that you really couldn't get 15, 20 years ago, and now there's these importers bringing them in. The retail market in New York is crazy. I've got a little store near me called September, and everyone that works there is like in their 20s or 30s, and they've gotten to know me. They've gotten to know what I like, how I cook, what I eat. And every time I don't want this. I don't want the same thing twice. I had this.
Right.
I liked it. I liked Norella Mascalese. I like this Ruche. I like this Schiava. Give me something like that, and they'll just surprise me with
to
something.
To drink the same wine is silly.
What's
There's
the point?
Too many varieties.
I had
there.
It. I loved it. You know, I can always go back and get another bottle, but push me.
Right.
Talk about what's on the menu now at Hearth so that the listeners who aren't fortunate enough to live in the city or know you get a sense of what you do. Because it's really chef-driven. It's really seasonal. It's really, really – I mean, you're one of my favorite restaurants in the city.
Well,
the
thanks,
food's great.
Dude. It's a tough time of year for us because we're very, very green market driven restaurant, and we joke and call it the brown market right now because it's brown.
And this winter sucks.
It
came in early in December, and it has not let go.
And it's tough. You know, you get spoiled on that quality stuff, and now we're forced to go elsewhere, and it's, you know, listen, nobody's going to say it's not as good, right? I mean, just period, end of story. It's like it's much better when you're getting it from 60 miles away and it was picked yesterday.
Yeah, period.
Not that that resonates on everybody's palate, and I think we do a really great job at making delicious food. You know, the food at Hearth has always been, for 10 years, not about novelty and not about trend and not about whatever. It's like I'm not a big reinvention guy. I have no interest in it, really, and it might sound boring, but I kind of like seeing the same dish over and over again and having it be executed well and consistently. You know, we have a grilled marinated quail dish on the menu that's been on the menu for 10 fucking years, you know? And like some people will say, oh, well, that's lame and, you know, that's not you being creative, but it fills a slot that, you know, people love it. They come back for it. I think it expresses who I am and what the restaurant is. And it works on every level. It's executed well. It tastes great all the time. And it's like, I don't mind having a slot filled by something like that, that I don't have to worry about, you know? We change the menu a lot. But, you know, dead of winter now, so things are bigger, richer. You know, we do a bolito misto with veal tongue and short rib and chicken thigh and cotechino sausage that we make. And it sits in this, like, incredibly beautiful clear broth that has just incredible depth of flavor and a bunch of cabbage and carrots and onions and potatoes. And it's like, I ate it last night for dinner because I hadn't really tucked into a whole one in quite a while. And I wanted to see where it was at. And I sat down with a half a glass of red wine at about 10 o'clock and tucked into this thing. And it was great.
And you have a couple of sauces with it too. I remember this dish.
Yeah,
from
we
NCM.
Do. Yeah, we serve condiments, you know, so with salsa verde and the mostarda di Cremona and like a horseradish sauce with it. And It's simple and delicious, and that's
And I remember the dish from Insieme. It must have been 8 or 9 years ago, and it comes in a bowl. And like you said, you've got the cotechino, this beautiful round piece of meat. You've got the other braised cuts sitting alongside. The broth is, I don't know if you clarify it as a consommé.
Yeah, or
if
we clarify it.
You have to clarify it. And consommés are something that...
We don't have to, but we choose to because
it just looks dope.
It's exciting to see that thing.
So now those vegetables, that carrot, that celery, that potato, that cabbage is floating in this beautiful, simple broth. The smell coming out of it is just killer because it's like
really
a double,
spicy olive oil
consommé.
Floating on top.
Dots of this great olive oil floating on top. It is, if that isn't soul satisfying, then check your pulse and go
and
to
that's,
the doctor.
You know, listen, that's what we do. And I think that in a lot of ways you can't go wrong with that because it speaks to people in a soulful way. Yeah. We make the cotechino ourselves. Absolutely. Listen, you need all kinds of restaurants to make this city happen, you know? And I thank God that there's, like, the Contras and the Estellas of the world and the Elms and the Ateras and, you know, like, it makes our city great.
The best.
And I'm just, I'm really happy and proud to fill in the slot that we fill in, which is that, you know, like, really simple, delicious, wholesome, Italian-inspired, simple deliciousness. You know, that's what we do.
You had a when I was there last year filming with you, you had a machine that I'd seen a few times already. I think Mike White had one.
Yeah, the extruder.
The extruder, and it's a company in Pennsylvania.
Yes,
it's an American.
Arco Bolano.
Thank you. Give him a shout out. It's a company in America. It's an American company now that's using this old Italian technology that's allowing chefs to have these small pasta extruders in your kitchen. So you explain the difference because as a host, if I tell the story, it's not the point. But the difference between extruded pasta and egg-based pasta.
Right.
And then what you're doing with some of those pasta shapes today on the menu.
Well, it's weird because it really creates, you know, if the layman thinks about pasta, you think of two kinds of pasta. You think of the dried stuff that's on the shelf, the Barillas of the world with all the different shapes, alphabet shapes to whatever, curly cues, what have you. And then you have the world of fresh pasta where... Egg base, you make a dough and you sheet it out and you put it through the machine that everybody sees, right? And you do thin sheets and you could either make a ravioli or an agnolotti, or you can cut it into fettuccine or pappardelle, and that's the fresh world of pasta. Well, now that we have extruders, right, available to us, countertop extruders, in a lot of ways it's like a third class of pasta because we're not drying the pot. So we're extruding our own doughs, and a lot of the doughs are just semolina and water,
period.
The way Barilla is.
Right.
But the difference is we're not going through that crazy drying process to create something that's shelf-stable. So we run a batch, and we put it into a container, and we put it in the freezer. So it's somewhere between the fresh stuff that you rolled out and the dried stuff that you put on the thing, because it cooks quick, and it doesn't have quite the toothsomeness of a Barilla. But it's also not as soft and luxurious as the egg-based pasta. So in a lot of ways, it really has created a third genre of pasta in my mind.
You're right. And it's not – I mean, I don't want to shit on all dry – I mean, Sataro, Gragnano.
Oh, no. Dry pastas are great.
Right. But so what you're able to do now – and this is the first time I've seen this in America, what you're able to do now. Because you had something in Insieme that was much different where you had to like crows underneath the table and you were cranking.
No, it was an extruder that was hand-cranked.
So before this machine, you were like putting an anvil and a 9-pound hammer.
Literally like old school with a little torque.
I remember that. That's correct.
That you put on the side of the thing and you torque it.
Yes.
And you know what's funny? Grub Street – back in the day when this is like early Grub Street,
right,
when I think Josh Ozersky was still there, they did a piece on us at NCMA making pasta like it was 1849 or something. And there's a picture of me and my sous chef kind of torquing this thing online. And it's a really cool device.
It's really cool. But this machine allows
not efficient and not cost effective.
Not efficient and not
cool.
Cost effective. Total labor, love, but cool. So with this thing allows you to do that. But this thing so ups the ante because for listeners out there, I mean, egg-based pasta is just, it's softer, it's subtle, it's silky, it's delicious, it's different. It's ragnolotti, it's ravioli, it's a pappardelle. But, and then dry pasta, the good ones like Sataro and Gragnano are great, but they take 12, 14, 18
minutes to cook.
Doesn't work in a kitchen. They're picking up. And if you blanch them, you're kind of killing buying them. So this is allowing you to use that same dough, get that same toothsomeness.
And also,
because you're cutting them through these bronze dyes to get that crazy surface that people don't think it matters. But if you looked under a magnifying glass the surface of your pompous,
you don't even need a magnifying glass.
It's like the surface of the moon. There's little crevices and lumps, and that picks up the sauce. And anyone that doesn't think that matters is crazy. What are you doing with
skinny? Once in a while, I do... I have a die that does Kitara, which is a square spaghetti.
That's my grandmother used to have. I have my grandmother's guitar at home.
Yep.
Which is a metal device that looks like
you put a sheet on it and push it through, right?
And on the bottom, right in the bottom is a tray. You put a rolling pin on it and it cut. And her Kitara recipes was always, it was like a dozen egg yolks and a pound of flour.
Uh-huh.
It was all egg yolk.
Right.
And I remember as a kid, it was like my favorite pasta.
So we do a simple semolina and water hydration in the extruder. And it has all those crevices that you talk about. And, you know, towards the end of the night when the pasta water is getting really starchy and white from cooking pasta in it all night, you know, we have pecorino around and I have cracked black pepper around. So I'm often making cacio e pepe for soigne mid-courses or whatever. And you know, the way that those ridges absorb that cheese sauce is just, it's magic. And, so that machine has been an immense amount of, has provided us with so much fun. It's a little toy. You know, it was funny because I bought it because I had to lay off, you know, during 08 and 09 when shit got really scary, I had to lay off my butcher who worked all day. He butchered fish, he butchered meat, and he made pasta. And I was like, I don't want to not make pasta, but I don't have this guy to do the rolling out pasta anymore. And I was like, I'm going to buy this extruder, you know, and it cost me $6,000 or whatever. And I thought it was going to be an incredible time saver. But the fact is, it's not. Like, you still need somebody to operate that machine. You got to clean the machine. And but I'm really happy to have it, and you could play around with all kinds of stuff in there now.
It has a blade that'll cut the shapes. You've got a million different dies you can put on there to get.
We have like 25 dies.
Yeah, it's so cool. So it gives you this pasta program.
Yeah, and you could hydrate with anything, right? You don't have to hydrate with water.
Right.
So you make black olive stock with a bunch of olive pits or something, and you could hydrate with that, or you could hydrate with beet juice, or you could hydrate. Semolina with anything you want, so it's really limitless, you know. Or you could add cocoa powder. I mean, it's really just been so much fun.
Right, you could toast the flour beforehand a little bit to get toasted semolina pasta. It's
insane.
Crazy.
It gives you
a whole new box of crayons to play with.
Yep, it is, and I love it.
Talk a bit, and I don't want to. I'm trying never to be didactic on the radio show or the TV show. That's not what we do. We're sort of cheerleaders for the community, but every so often. There's something that drives me crazy, and I know it drives you crazy. And I had always thought this was like a generational thing, because obviously you and I, well, me, I'm a dinosaur, and you're a lesser dinosaur. And kids under the age of, say, 35 or 30, cell phones in restaurants.
Yeah.
So the only person I know that kind of agreed with my position, who's of that age, who just turned, well, maybe she's 30, Jordana Rothman, who's a great food writer in New York City. She was Time Out in New York for years, ran that section. Now she's freelance. Her boyfriend is Daniel Krieger, who's one of the preeminent food photographers in the city. A lot of what you see on Eater, a lot of what you see from the Times is his work. So they're kind of this Uber Brooklyn chef couple. And she had this great blog piece about trying to encourage kids of her age when they go to restaurants, get that freaking smartphone and put it in your purse, put it in your jacket pocket, and don't touch it for 2 hours. Live in the space. You're out with friends. You're at a restaurant.
Yeah,
there's this conviviality. You're at a table. You don't need to be talking to friends 5 blocks away, 5 miles away, 5 towns. Just be there.
Right.
So, I mean, is this driving? Is it? It must drive you nuts, because if I'm sitting at the table one more time and I see nobody talking, they're all on their stuff, or snapping pictures and Instagram, just be there.
I'm able to get a perspective as an operator who walks around my dining room floor every night. You know, you really see how kind of it's pervasive, right? I mean, it's like
it's addictive.
I'll go out to the dining room and stand in the corner and just watch for a while. I love doing that. It's kind of cool because you could see people's reaction to food, and you could just kind of
get a sense of the room,
right? That's, I really enjoy that part of my job, and it's really fascinating to see the level of engagement that people have with their devices. It's kind of mind blowing, and I think everybody has noticed it because you go out to dinner and you see it next to you or whatever. But the perspective I get is a little bit amplified because I see the entire room and everybody doing it. And I have bantered around at our manager's meeting over the last, 3 months now, trying to figure out a way to incentivize people to unplug, right? And, the whole impetus behind the name Hearth as it being the center of the home, and Hearth was where the light of the fire was, and it's where stories were told, and it's where you engaged with your family, and it was where you cooked, and it was where, you connected, right? That's what Hearth is. And that's always been a meaningful story for us to tell. And I really want to be part of encouraging people to unplug. And I'm obviously not going to be didactic about it, and I can't shove it down people's throat because there's no denying there's the mom who has kids at home who's dining and she has to be tethered, and there's the doctor who's a heart surgeon who has to be tethered, and I understand that, but you could opt out, right? And I want to figure out a way to incentivize people who don't have to be tethered to unplug and enjoy each other's company, right?
Right. The doctors and the mothers are the exceptions.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
we're talking about the other 99%,
but it's
for
like,
whom this thing has just become,
yeah,
like living in the moment doesn't mean anything anymore.
That's right.
It means living in the moment via my handheld.
That's right. And I want to be like, you know what? I'll give you a free bowl of gnocchi, or I'll give you a free dessert. I'll do something, or pour you some cool sherry or cool Madeira. I'm going to do something to say thank you for you to say that you're going to turn off your phone and be present with your guests. I mean, when I go out to dinner with my wife, it's like unwritten. It's like, if I take out my fucking phone in the middle of dinner with my wife, no way.
Right.
Not allowed. And I think it shouldn't be allowed.
Well, thanks. I'm with you. And I think we're unfortunately swimming against the current. But it was encouraging for me because Jordana's, she's young, she's cool, she's hip, she's as engaged as everybody. And she is completely of this generation saying, I too am shocked. This is just horseshit. Just be the. We're at this place. We're celebrating this moment. We're around a table. To your point about Hearth, let's
it's just
enjoy
social,
this.
It's
thing.
Not a social movement. It's an anti-social movement.
Thank you.
It's like anti-social.
So people don't get the idea that Hearth is just full of heavy dishes. You're incredibly talented with fish. Talk about a couple of fish dishes you might have on the menu to close out.
Every time this year I bring back the cachuco, which is my favorite fish stew on the planet. It's like from. It hails from the seaside of Tuscany, Livorno, Via Reggio, tomato base. Tons of calamari goes into the base that actually gets removed later. It's really cool. You put in these huge calamari that are like the size of your forearm, and then at the end, when the stew is done, when the base is done, it's like they shrink to the size of your forefinger because they lend an immense amount of salinity and oceanic flavor. Because they're almost all water.
Yeah.
So that's one of my favorite fish dishes. We do a roasted cod with salt cod and black cabbage and smoked chickpeas that we've been doing for 3 or 4 years now that I really love, and that comes back every year.
How do you walk me through the cachuco? Walk me through it.
The
so
cachuco,
right? You're making that stock with the so the squid sacrificing
so it start,
its goodness.
Yeah, it starts with sofrito, a white sofrito, so fennel, celery, white onion, a boatload of it minced, really small. You fry it out with a lot of good dried oregano, pepperoncini, and then to that you add like 15 pounds of calamari. It releases its liquid. The liquid
instantly. Boom.
Oh, well, yeah, pretty fast.
Yeah.
It's just over the next hour, it's like releasing all of its liquid into it. That liquid is concentrating down. After that, it's a big bottle of white wine. That goes down to nothing. And then you add good tomatoes. And then you cook it until the fat separates out. And then you push the entire thing through a food mill.
Mm.
And then that's your base, right? So that's what you – we also steep a bunch of lemon zest in there.
To lighten it up a bit.
And then you adjust it. And then that's your base that you hold on the station. And then on the pickup – you just saute some beautiful shrimp, and there's some mussels and some clams and some little bits of pieces of black sea bass right now is the fin fish that we put in it. And then you cook that, you deglaze it, you add the base, it all comes up. You squeeze some lemon.
Evie olive oil.
And then some gremolata at the end. And it's just, it's incredibly, it's so rich and deeply flavored in a wonderful way. I love it.
Sounds great now.
Big crouton on the bottom, soaks it all up. It gets that big soggy crouton at the end.
All right, so there you go. You got a pasta dish. You got, I mean, the food at Hearth, the whole menu top to bottom has always been stellar.
Thanks.
Marco Kerner has been my chef. He's a chef, still loves cooking. If you couldn't tell that from this interview, please. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. We'll be back next week. I have no idea who my guests are. I've got them written down. Yeah, the next 3 or 4 weeks, we've got some solid guests back-to-back on the program. So stay tuned. Again, you're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. If you're so inclined, if you have some extra shekels banging around in your pocket, this is a donation-based organization, so go to heritageradionetwork.org, give a little contribution if you like what you're listening to, much the same as you would do or might be inclined to do with public radio and public television. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Pleasure to have Marco Canora here, and spread the love. If you're ever in New York City, Hearth Restaurant, incredible place, or any of the terroir wine bars around the city, great places to visit, super curated wine lists and food to match. See you next week, folks.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.